obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, my name's Jerry. And I said that she asked if there was any particular way she wanted or I wanted to be introduced. I said, yes, tell them to take everything I say with a grain of salt. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon family groups. And as we start here, I have to remember a couple things. One is that podium's a very dangerous place for a person like me. I have a timer here for a reason because I'll never shut up. So this is my timer here. And two, the most important thing is that I am here because I love alcoholics. They are some of the most influential, important people in my lives. They are fathers, they are mothers, they are brothers, they are wives, they are sisters, they are in-laws, they are ex-in-laws. The line is long and distinguished. And if I didn't care about them, I probably wouldn't need to be here. But I'm here because I love them dearly. And, you know, I guess the best place to begin, as they always say, is in the beginning. I'd like to tell you I'm not nervous at all about this. My wife was wondering why I was trying to smoke in the shower this morning. I'll be fine. Whenever I get an opportunity to do this, I'm so very thankful because it is an opportunity to share the experience, strength, and hope, at least of my story. And if there's something that I say up here today that you feel akin with, that's great. If there's something up here today I say that offends you, I'm sorry, but this is the way that it works for me. My earliest recollection of 12-step recovery was not in Alateen, although that's where I officially started. The first year of my mother's sobriety, and we'll get back to that in a little bit, I spent in the Valley Club in AA rooms. And I could do Chapter 5 long before I got to my first Alateen meeting. So my background in listening to some of those people in that meeting, and I had no idea who I was listening to at the time, but I was listening to Chuck C. I was listening to Norm Alp. I was listening to a very young Clancy. I was listening to people that I had no idea were such heavy hitters in AA. And that's really how my program's based. I've been accused of for years of working in an AA-based Al-Anon program, and I probably do, and that's just what works for me. When my wife and I go places, they are shocked when it's she that is the alcoholic and it is me that is the Al-Anon. And, because I have that personality that it talks about in the literature of understanding ourselves, angry, smug, self-righteous, and dominating, that really is how I got here, and that's how I covered all my insecurities with you, was being in that fashion. As I alluded to earlier, I was raised by alcoholics. Kind of sounds like being raised by wolves. They were actually absolutely wonderful people. They both have long-term sobriety in AA today, and some of the best things that we get to do is go give them cakes. Dad is, I have to talk with my PIO here. What is he, 30... 36? Oh, yeah. He's a year behind me. I like to remind him about that. So he's 37 years sober, and my mom, we just celebrated her 24th. And, no one's crying in that family anymore because someone's tore up by drinking. Now, that doesn't mean that those of us who practice our own disease of Al-Anonism aren't running around getting crazy. Okay, today's been a great example of that. I would love to tell you that everything, because I'm coming to speak tonight, has just been wonderfully serene, and I would just be absolutely lying to you. There is nothing better than trying to get, your family together for a road trip with a 7-year-old who's much more interested in watching her shows on television and playing her games and playing with her puppy. And don't you understand? I'm speaking tonight, let's go. She doesn't care, and that actually is exactly the way that it is supposed to be. It reminds me of what the truly important things are, and I can promise you today that we're going to laugh, we're going to cry, and we're going to laugh because we were all tore up, and we're going to cry because it's so much better now, and it is called Al-Anon. If you are new here, Some of the things I'm going to say are probably going to not make any sense to you whatsoever, because when I got here, I was here to help you, first of all, because I've never seen anybody come in here that needed any help whatsoever. You know, this isn't a place that you win in a lottery. Oh, yay, I get to go to Al-Anon. You know, it's kind of the last resort. I know for me that in my mom's first year of sobriety, I was tied up, thrown in the back seat of the car, and I was dragged to my first Alateen meeting. And then she threw me in there and said, please do something with this kid. Not because of anything she did, but because of the things that I was doing. You know, growing up, you know, it talks in our literature that alcoholism respects no lines whatsoever. And, you know, and I can tell you that is absolutely true. My parents, you know, when the drinking, you know, there's always been drinking, but when the drinking got bad during that last 3 or 4 year period, you know, we lived at the top of a hill in an area of Sherman Oaks, an exclusive area called Royal Woods. You know, we had the 2 brand new cars in the driveway that rotated every year. Our house even had a white picket fence. And on the outside, everything just looked wonderful. On the inside, as my wife was fond of saying these days, it was an absolute 3-ring circus. You know, and that was my normal. You know, I would listen to my friends at school talk about how things went during the weekend, and I just wasn't hearing the same stuff that I was hearing, you know, at home. I thought everybody's parents crashed cars, went to jail, slashed their wrists, jumped out of windows, took pills, wound up in hospitals, and that, again, was my normal, you know. And I would absolutely react to that normal, and this is where I get to practice my disease. My disease is one of isolation, because I'm really good in the middle of a crowd of being very, very alone. And I learned that as a self-defense mechanism growing up. And it doesn't mean that that's the alcoholic's fault. If there's one thing I really want to get across today, if there's nothing else, is that there is nothing that those people did to me. As a matter of fact, they took care of 4 children at a time when they could barely take care of themselves. And if you folks are having trouble with a higher power or that concept, I would love for you to tell me how you think that occurred. Because it wasn't certainly anything that we were doing. You know, we were, in fact, trying our best to mess this up. You know, isolation was something I was professional at. Manipulation was something I learned very, very early. I laugh when my daughter is becoming somewhat pro at this at such an early age. So I always say she's going to be a 12 of some kind. We're not sure which one. You know, but I learned very early growing up that if I coughed twice and sneezed and complained of a sore stomach, I missed school. Now, that wasn't because I was really sick, obviously. It was because my parents were hungover and they really didn't want to deal with me. You know, and I pretty much missed the entire 5th grade doing that. You know, it was easy to do. You know, again, it was my will. I wanted, as we say in here, self-will run riot. And again, I'm an absolute firm believer, and I was doing the absolute best that I could do at the time, given the information and the abilities that I had. Now, that's very important, because that was the abilities that I had. When I got to these rooms, I was given a concept of a higher power. Now, I was raised in a particular faith. I went to 13 years of their schools. I do identify these days as a recovering Catholic. And, you know, with that faith, they presented to me the exact same God that I believe in now as a higher power. I just had absolutely zero connect with that, period. I thought it was very rote. I just, you know, we're up, we're down, we're doing the gymnastics. It didn't mean anything to me. And for anybody here who is Catholic, that's wonderful. It's a great faith. It just didn't work for me. So when I got to these rooms and the second word I heard in these rooms was God, I couldn't run for the doors fast enough. I'd had enough of that God that I thought I knew. That God was a punishing God. That was a God that kept books. That was a God that I was never going to be even with as far as making the grade, you know, because I had done so many horrible things, or at least I thought that I had. You know, so the God that I was introduced to here was one that was a compassionate God, that was a loving God, that above all else was a merciful God. And that all I had to do if I wanted these things to work and to feel better was to be able to submit to something that was greater than myself. Now, I don't know about you, but, you know, I was so tired of getting hurt growing up that I just figured that I was going to be my own best weapon. You know, hence how I would treat people. how I would stay on top of people, how I would be that angry, smug, self-righteous individual, because I was protecting myself again. It was all about making sure that I wasn't hurt anymore. You know, my parents had separate watering holes. My dad was one of those young hotshot television executives in Hollywood. He's one of those rare individuals that started in the mailroom at Channel 5 when he was 18 years old, and 30 years later was running one of the local television stations. He was the youngest general manager in the history of Los Angeles television and the longest reigning. And what goes with that is a lot of entertaining, you know. And you know, that was kind of the culture I grew up in. My dad and I laugh to this day. We're very much opposites in a whole bunch of stuff. I always joke that as long as we don't talk about my job, money, politics, or religion, we're fine, you know. And, you know, we just have to stay down the narrow of the stuff that we can actually talk about because we're very differing there. And he always sat there, and he wonders how, you know, he says, I don't understand how in the middle of, you know, this Democratic Hollywood crowd, I raised a Republican conservative cop. And I said, well, it's because I grew up in that other crowd, and I don't like it very much, and that's okay. But what I've learned in these rooms is acceptance, and I've learned that my way is not always the best way, and getting back to that belief in a higher power and in a power greater than myself. During the last bit of drinking that went on in that house was the one up in Sherman Oaks. My wife has actually had the opportunity to go see that house, and I wasn't even involved in it. There's been several pilgrimages up to that house. On the last night of drinking, they had come back from their separate watering holes. They had an argument, I'm sorry, my mother had come home first, and she was she figured out that she had a drinking problem. And she figured out the only way that she was going to survive or not or get over this drinking problem was, in fact, to die. So she slashed her wrist, and she began bumping around the house because this is a very dramatic family. You know, this is a whole bunch of, Irish, Italians, Catholics, and everything's very dramatic. It's, you know, Sunday dinners are loud, food sticks to the wall, you know, that's good stuff. You know, grandma takes care of the house. And, you know, my mom came up to the screen door in my room, and I always laugh about that because I had a screen door in my room to keep me in, you know, because they didn't want me wandering around, and they didn't know that I'd already learned how to just take the webbing out of the bottom and scoot out, and again, my own form of manipulation. And my mom kind of passed out in front of the door, and I'm like, I really didn't think anything of it. It was nothing new. Now, I didn't see all the blood that was going on, you know, but I thought it was kind of odd that at 10 years old that I was like, yeah, you know, this is kind of normal. My dad came home from where he was out partying and kind of figured out there was a problem and called the fire department. Back then we didn't have paramedics. They brought the big truck and the ambulance, and they threw her in the back, and they took her to the hospital. And they came home about 3 hours later and began to have that fight. Now, I alluded to earlier, obviously, what I do for a living. It's not hard to figure out, and I can tell you from my experience at my job, if you try and kill yourself in the state of California, you're going to get 72 hours of a lockdown in a psych ward speaking to people that are going to help you. So I don't know what it is that they told the doctor how to, you know, lateral marks up your wrists were some type of horrible curling iron accident, but somehow they got her out of there, and she came back home that night, and they began to have that fight. And it was a very violent fight. My brothers and sisters and I were fortunate in that my parents were violent towards each other. There wasn't a great deal of violence towards us. As my mom likes to point out, you know, don't make your father out to be the heavyweight champion of the world. She threw him through the shower door that night. She was giving everything they got. I heard a lot of things breaking and whatnot. And I remember that feeling that I had at that very moment. And it's a feeling that I've had many times. Part of me was just absolutely completely empty and void. The other part was, you know, I love them because they're my parents, and I hate what they do. And, you know, and again, it was just all focusing on me, that I had no clue or concept that my brothers and sisters downstairs were probably going through the same feelings. I was just focus in on me and mine. You know, if you spend any time with Alateens, if you listen to folks that grew up in alcoholic homes, we tend to be old souls. I know that I took over the job of of taking care of my brothers and sisters long before this incident occurred, because, you know, my parents were busy. You know, the alcoholics are busy people. And they, you know, no one offered me that job. That was my own ego. That was my own, you know, feeling of, well, someone's got to do this, you know. To this day, you know, some 40 years later, it still is a problem in our relationship that I have to be very careful with my brothers and sisters and say, I'm not their parent. They have parents, just like I'm not their higher power. They have a higher power. I just have to be me and be the best me and brother that I can be to them. Sometimes that works, but as we have found out with one of my brothers in particular, sometimes that does not. During that fight, my dad came into my room and he said, "Wake up!" And I said, "That's about the silliest thing I've ever heard in my life." But yeah, we're up, and he said, "Get dressed. I'm going to take you somewhere safe." Now I thought years later how funny that was, because, you know, I've got a guy that's just gotten home from a bar. He's probably blown about a 2-1, and he's going to put us in the car and he's going to take us somewhere safe. You know, but then again, this was back in the early 70s, where, you know, you had to make an appointment to go to jail for drunk driving. You know, and it's one of those things where, okay, fine. And I got my brothers and sisters up, and we got them herded out to the car. And I remember we were sitting in the car, and my dad came running out of the house with a jacket in his hand, poured arms like this, and running around the side of the house. And I invariably knew, I just instinctively knew, she's jumping. And what had happened was that my mom had had another moment of clarity and figured again she had a problem and death was the only way out. And she took a bottle of Seconal, and she jumped out of a second-story window. And as we turned the corners, when she hit the ground, and she bounced. And, you know, my mom is ornery, like most alcoholics I know, God bless them, because as she said in her story, because she lived through that, and in her story she said, you know, right when I was going out the window, before God was merciful and allowed me to pass out so I didn't feel any of this, my last thought was, I probably have a drinking and pill problem, you know. That is what she had to go through to hit her bottom, quite literally. There's a lot of humor in that this day. That the fashion of the time was a show called That Girl, Marlo Thomas, for those of us who are of my age. And there was, you know, the boots that are now making their comeback that come up to just below your knees. And mom was wearing a pair of those boots and a mink coat when she went out that window. And, you know, for a long time, she still had those boots. And every now and again, we will pull them out of the closet. And, hey, look, they're the jumping boots, you know. And, hey, mom, 82nd Airborne, good job, you know. And, you know, that's just the bottom she had to hit. For years, I thought that was something that I had done, you know, because being a good Al-Anon, a good Alateen, this somehow has to be my fault. You know, that is our disease. That is the craziness of our disease. It's our sick thinking. You know, when mom was in the hospital getting being fitted for the break for her back brace, because she broke her back in that fall, the man who fit her back brace was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's where she got her start. That is her story. That's what she had to do. About a year, you know, and of course, my parents got divorced after that, because you have to chronologically go through this stuff. And when after the divorce, my dad went to live in the bachelor capital of the world in Los Feliz, and a year later, he figured out he had issues, and he got sober. And 3 years after that, with a little bit of sobriety under their belt, my parents were just crazy enough to figure that they still loved each other, so they married each other again. I have been the best man at my father's wedding twice. Someone explain that to me. Math just doesn't add up, you know, but I have been blessed enough to and fortunate enough to stand up for my father twice now. And, you know, then to the same woman, which is even better. And that is something that, you know, I always, he and I will always have. The first year of sobriety for my mom, I wish to tell you it was great. You know, once she got into AA, everything was hunky-dory. Well, it was good. It was okay for her. I mean, she was smart. She was sitting at a meeting a day, because that was the rules back then. You had to go to one a day. And, you know, like I said, I spent a lot of time at the Valley Club. I learned how to shoot pool and play poker in that place, you know. And I sat in meetings and I listened to some very heavy hitters, like I said. Had no idea what they meant, you know. To this day, you know, I wish I'd gotten Father Ted's surrender flag. It's something that my father has had for years, and, you know, it's one of his prized possessions. And, you know, I didn't apply it. I think it was pretty cool, but I certainly didn't apply it in my life, because this was something they were doing. But I was out there still doing my thing. I was still out there doing my craziness. You know, my thing was to garner attention. Now, straight A's might garner a little bit of attention, but if you really want someone's attention, get straight F's. Oh, that just gets everybody's attention in the house, you know. And even though it was negative attention, it was still attention anyway. And, you know, a lot of behavioral issues, and as my wife and I were talking about earlier today, a lot of rage, you know, and a lot of anger. And again, I, you know, as I've heard in meetings, we used to lash out at random, you know, it didn't really matter who it was. It was just whoever was convenient, sorry, you know, and you would get a lot of that. And when I got to Alateen, I'd love to tell you that I just grabbed it and said, this is a wonderful way of life, and ran with it. And I spent about the first 6 months sitting there trying to, we played a game, and I won't use the word, it was MSU, it was make stuff up. You know, and it was who could tell the best story in the room. But, you know, it just, well, let me tell you what happened at my house, you know. And finally, my first sponsor, Gary, I remember distinctly, he said, you know, Jerry, every story that you seem to come up with in here could be answered with a serenity prayer. Why don't you try looking at it instead of just saying it at the beginning of the meeting? Hence, the first person who ever pulled my covers. I didn't like Gary much after that. You know, because what I was a very scared, paranoid, you know, 11-year-old who was still looking for people to validate me. I would dare you to care about me. I say this a lot about my brother. He's a victim bully. Well, that's exactly what I was. You know, I absolutely, positively dared you to care about me. When you got close, I would just do something that would make you run southbound. You know, and then dare you to come back and care some more.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
You know, and if anybody else has done that, I'm sorry. You know, it seems like an odd way to go. But, again, that was just part of how I would protect myself. I figured you were going to hurt me anyway, so I was just going to beat you to the punch. And what a horrible way to have to live. And when I got here, they said, by the way, you don't have to live that way anymore. It's a choice. And I can't tell you how hard that is when you're a newcomer. Of course I have to live this way. You don't understand what I've been through. I can tell you stories that make your toes curl, the things that I've had to deal with. I absolutely deserve to act in this fashion. But I've also heard people say, I absolutely deserve to drink because I've been in that situation, and these are people that have managed to stay sober. So why can't I change my thinking? Took a long time. When there are still days when the old tapes, they're reel to reel, they still work real well. You know, if I want to be a victim and I want to be a martyr, that tape will play as good as it played 38 years ago. No questions asked. You know, they've always told me that if I don't wish to use the tools of this program, that my misery was refunded 100% at the door if I chose to walk out, and that being here was a choice, and that sometimes these choices were going to be incredibly difficult, but that I would learn a new way of life, and I wouldn't have to feel like I did way back then. Now, I went through years in Alateen, and I got to tell you, as I was one of the first kids in the group in Alateen that actually I got my license first. So that meant that I was the taxi. So we had meetings that we went to basically every night if we wanted to. We had Monday night was over in Arcadia. Tuesday night was Glendale. Wednesday night was Mar Vista out in Culver City. Thursday night was one of the two biggies. That was Bob and Becca's meeting out in Brentwood. Friday night was a night off if we wanted it, or we had La Cañada. We would take Saturday night off to reintroduce ourselves to our families, and Sunday night was the other biggie, that was Lola and John's meeting out in Santa Monica. And the day would generally go on the lines of, I would get home from school, I would jump in my little 71 VW, and I'm here to tell you that you can get 11 people in a 71 VW. And I would grab something to eat, and I would go about the pickup service. I would run to the west side. I'd run to Glendale. I'd run back over to San Gabriel. And we'd stick 11 people in this car, and we'd go to the meeting that we were going to go to. And then after the meeting, I don't know what it is about Alateens, but we have to go get thrown out of some local eatery. You know, it's just something we like to do. So we'd usually be over at Uncle John's over in Santa Monica and be tossed out after about 9 or 10 o'clock. And then I would get back in the car with these 11 people, and we'd start the drop-off proceedings again. And I'd get home about 1 o'clock in the morning, and then my parents would be sitting at the door going, where have you been? I've been in a meeting. Wasn't that yesterday? You know. And that's how I did a lot of the – I understand the microphone went off. Sorry about that. But I'll try. I've never been told I've been quiet. So the You know, that's kind of how we did Alateen for a while. And I got to tell you, and I love sharing it with the kids that I'm lucky enough to sponsor a meeting in Temecula on Monday nights. And I always tell them, I said, you know, I have friends in Alateen that I've had for close to 40 years now that we still keep in contact with. We used to do that on Facebook all the time. That was amazing. We probably had about 200 kids, you know, because we traveled as Alateens. We went not only to SCAC, which is coming up again, the Southern California Alateen Conference, but we went to Arizona Alateen Conference. We went to, back then it was TAC, it was the Texas Alateen Conference, but they got so big it became East Texas and West Texas and NOMAC up in Michigan, and we went all over the country. And there are friends to this day that I still have and stay in contact with because this program has taught me how to have relationships. You know, I've heard about compassion in these rooms. I have to be honest, I actually learned how compassion works in open AA meetings. I would highly recommend, and if you're silly enough to ask me to sponsor you, you're going to go to an occasional open AA meeting because that is the place that, I would look at this big biker used to ride for the fifth chapter or something like that. And he's up there talking about how he had lost everything. His family was gone. His job was gone. He's couch surfing, but he's happy today because he's not drinking. And he knows that probably none of that other stuff is coming back. But today he's happy and he's up there crying. And how can you help but have compassion for that instead of all that anger that I came in with because I was so selfish that I thought they were drinking at me. And they weren't. They were doing the best that they could. My parents did not go to their high school counselor and say, I want to be a jackass. I want to ruin people's lives. I want to drink. But that's what happened. And it was by no choice of their own. If you subscribe to the belief that it is a disease, then all I can do is have nothing but compassion for the alcoholics in my life. It doesn't mean I still don't get mad at them. It just means that I don't get to act it out. I don't get to go the Al-Anon salute and go, oh, woe is me, and you know, and say, how sad, you know, look what they're doing to me again. I get to make a conscious decision as to whether I'm going to carry on and let this go, or if I want to wallow in it and get angry about it. These things are still my choice. You know, because as I said, I absolutely, my two first reactions to everything is fear and anger, and for me, they're interchangeable. If I'm angry at something, I'm going to be afraid of it. If I'm afraid of it, I'm probably angry at it. You know, and if I have to remember that these aren't horrible things, but what I do with them is what gives them character. I had sponsors tell me that no emotion was bad, is what I did with them. As long as I didn't let them rule me, you know, and be able to talk it out and be able to, you know, call someone or even just tell my wife, you know, I'm angry about something, you know. And there's nothing wrong with admitting that. I'm not less of a person. No one said that because I was in these rooms and I did the things I was supposed to do and read the literature and did steps and called sponsors and things like that, that life would not occur. It was not going to be a skip down the yellow brick road. They did promise me that I would have a different set of tools that I could use. So you would think that after going through all of that growing up, that the last thing I would ever do in my life would be to find and marry an alcoholic woman. I've done it twice now. And, you know, the first one, it is what it is. It didn't work out. As the song says, doesn't have to be any good guys or bad guys. It just didn't work out. And so after that was done, you know, it was like, I am in no way, shape, if I ever get married again, I sure as hell am not picking an alcoholic. And then I met my wife. And she was safe. I met her in an Al-Anon meeting, damn it, okay? And her sponsor set this up, and we always laugh about Robin the matchmaker. And, you know, but in the beginning, she wouldn't date me because I was a cop. You know, because she worked in the courts, and she knew what kind of dogs we were, and she's absolutely 100% correct. And, you know, I sat there, and I, because it was no, it was like, oh, okay, well, hold on a second. You know, you've told me no, I have to have it now, you know. And, you know, I know that we met in the Sunday morning Covina meeting, which we used to call church. It was a Sunday morning spiritual meeting. It was at 11 o'clock. There was usually about 40 to 50 people there. It was a great meeting. What was a lot of fun about that meeting was that the AAs were next door, about 200 strong. having their meeting, and they're in there just yucking it up. I mean, they're talking about going to jail and crashing cars and parole officers, and they're laughing, having a good old time. And it's so funny to see in the back of the room the ladies that are hearing through the very thin walls, you know, and there's a few of us guys getting really tight-jawed. How dare you have a good time, you know? And, you know, I had always said if I needed to confirm the presence and the voice of God in the room, it is laughter in a meeting. Because like I said, we're going to laugh about the tough times and we're going to cry about the good times. And that seems backwards, but that's where we wind up. You know, I know that I finally got her number from her, and I said, well, where else do you go to meetings? And she said, well, I go to this meeting in Brea. Oh, yeah, I know it real well. So I went to the meeting that night in Brea. I had never been there. And we went to coffee afterwards at Kelly's over and had a little coffee there, and we have... There has not been a day that we have not spoken or seen each other in almost the last 12 years. Now, not that we do anything quickly. She came to visit at Christmas, and this was in September, late September. She came to visit in Christmas, and she never left. And about January, the thought occurred to us that we should probably go to her folks' house and get her stuff. You know, and when we got there, they knew it was up. They had it boxed, you know, and... They had swatches of color on her bedroom wall. Would you get her out of here? I need an office, you know. And, you know, and that's a running gag to this day, you know, that we always laugh about. And, you know, we went through, you know, the courtship. And I remember the year before we got married, I said, I'm probably going to ask you to marry you at some point this year because I'm a real romantic, okay, you know. I do combat logistics, okay, you know. It's like, you know, and that's... and. You know, but I will tell you that I did well when I asked her to marry me. She had no idea it was coming. And, you know, what I noticed was, you know, during this time was that her drinking, you know, was getting a little interesting. And, you know, it just started with, you know, the usual just occasional, you know, glass of wine and whatnot. Now, because of my profession, I got to be honest, you know, and while I'm surrounded by alcoholics at work, I really find I don't have time. Now, if that's what keeps me out of these rooms, that's fine, because I'm not going to be arrogant and tell you that I know that the difference between alcoholics and Al-Anon is a simple allergy to booze, that we really act the same. We all have the two, if two's good, four's better mentality and self-preservation. I have always said that the big difference between about AAs and Al-Anons is just that AAs are about not drinking. You know, you call your sponsor up and said you slid into a family of six, and the question is, are you drinking? No. Okay, we can work with the rest of it. For you know, Al-Anons, it's about relationships. You know, I don't have a physical allergy to the booze as of yet, and I hope that never happens. If it does, I know where I need to go. And you know, I did at one point. Her father actually came over to help me with a mantle. We were building a mantle, and he said, "You know, we wanted to talk to you about something. We've noticed some signs and symptoms." And, of course, me being the good boyfriend immediately stood up, you know, for her honor. And how dare you come into my house, tell me that my wife may have a drinking problem. You may leave now, you know, type of thing. And you know, and we didn't talk to you for 6 months. How, you know, be done with you. And, you know, it was so funny because, you know, there was, you know, a time where I looked at this. And we had actually, and after we gotten married, we moved. And we didn't do anything difficult. We planned a wedding and we bought a house in the same, you know, 6 month period. Not because, you know, we're Al-Anons, we just do things quickly. And after we moved, and you know, I noticed that the drinking was getting really interesting. I noticed that she had absolutely no middle whatsoever. There was no one or two, there was one or two bottles. And I remember at one point I even told her, I said, you know, I know this isn't gonna go well, but we always promised each other that we would say something. And you know, you throw in a lot of signs and symptoms that you may have a problem with alcohol, and I just need to leave it at that. And awfully chilly in the house for the next couple of days, you know, as I would expect. But then soon after that, I was on the, we were both working for AFG. We were doing registration. Now, I'd love to tell you that everybody that comes to this program is really, really well. But we don't come here because we're well. So doing registration for a large convention, who's doing registration for this convention? I'm sure she or he is pulling what little hair they have out, because I remember sitting in the booth that weekend and people were just losing their minds over badges and stuff like that. And I remember that before we had gotten into that, it was coming up on Lent and me not being controlling or manipulative at all. I told my wife, I said, hey, honey, I got a good idea for Lent. Let's give up alcohol. You know, for me, it was not an issue at all. For her, she's marking days off a calendar like she's in jail, you know. And I remember one point she said, you know, do you know how many days are in Lent? I said, yes, 40 days. She goes, no, this year is 46. First time that's ever happened. How did that work? You know, and it was so funny where, we get towards that, you know, it was about a week before that was AFG. And, you know, we're in the booth over there and we're doing our thing. And I look over and there's some poor 80-year-old woman crying in front of my wife who's just tearing her up because she's in such a bad way. And I'm like, honey, why don't you go up and take a nap, you know. And I didn't put it together. I being that boneheaded Al-Anon, thought, okay, well, she hasn't had a drink in 40 days. Maybe she's not. It's all good. You know, I didn't see it. You know, and it, you know, when we got back and we had, you know, Easter Sunday, and actually I was working that night, and the next morning I had played hockey for about 40 years up until an injury a few years ago. And I had a Monday morning hockey game, which means that I worked PM shift at the jails at that point. And I got home and what had happened was, and part of her story is that she woke up after, you know, Easter Sunday, powering down a bottle and a half of alcohol because she could drink because we were done with Lent. And it was red wine, and she hated red wine, but that's what was in the house. And she kind of woke up on the couch about 10 minutes before I was supposed to get home from work and stumbled upstairs to clean up. And that was her moment of clarity where she says, this just wasn't normal. You know, and the next morning she's hung over, but I'm up early because I've got a hockey game, so she's got to keep appearances, so she's trying to do yoga in the front room. And she's in a great deal of pain, and I'm like, honey, you okay? I'm feeling, you know, are you all right? You're acting kind of distant. What is it about Al-Anons? We use that line all the time with our spouses. You seem kind of far away. Yeah, well, yeah, that's how relationships are sometimes. And she, you know, she did well, and I went to work after I got done with my hockey game, and you know, and I called her up and I said, hey, you know, just kind of, you seem kind of distant. Is everything okay? And she's, well, I'm here in cubicle hell. I really can't talk to you about what's going on here. The cubicles all have ears. I said, well, send me an email. And she did as she was asked to do. She sent me electronic email notification that she believed that she was an alcoholic and that she didn't know what she should do. And I should have hit the print button on that but I didn't, you know. And I tried to research that back in the sheriff's department's archives for years, see if I could find that. I could not. I said, well, you know, do you think you need to go to rehab? No. Okay, well, let's put you in touch with my mom, you know, and let's. Now, my mom had a very compassionate reaction to this. Her reaction was, oh, yay, we got another one, you know, and. And then the dreaded meeting with mom and dad, because we were going to have to say, yeah, I guess you were right 3 or 4 years ago. Thanks a lot, you know. And they were wonderfully compassionate. And I remember dad's head was down. He's shaking his head, and my wife's in tears. And I'm thinking, what is this? And he got up. He goes, I'm so sorry that you're just like me, you know. And I remember that. And I'm like, what a wonderful thing to say at that moment. And we're here to support you. And what is it that you need from us? And there's no shame in it. It's a disease, and let's do what you need to do. And, you know, I can't tell you what a wonderful gift that was. In the middle of all this, when we got married, because we both had practice marriages, as we call it, and we had no children from those marriages, we decided very quickly, well, if we're going to have kids, we have got to get going. And, you know, so because I'm, you know, 40 and you're 38 and, you know, Clint Eastwood can have kids in their 70s, but, you know, I don't think that's going to be our thing, and let's get this figured out. And, you know, you would like to say that it just immediately happened, everything was hunky-dory, but, oh, no, there's doctors, and there's specialists, and there's turkey basters, and there's just, oh, how wonderful, you know. And and we get this all done, and you know, and we've been trying, and there was a bunch of, you know, there was actually one or two miscarriages. We think we're pregnant. No, we're not. Okay, fine. And, you know, 8 days after she quit drinking, she got pregnant. So, again, you people who have trouble with a higher power, please tell me how that happened. You know, and this little diva in the front row is what we have today. And we thank God for her every night. even when she drives us nuts. You know, I have been called many, many things in my life, in my career, many of them not good, some of them good, but the best thing I've ever been called is Dada. Yeah. And every night when we say our prayers, thank you. I'm not quite there yet. Every night, I thought that was the shut up one. Okay. And every night when we say our prayers, the last thing I ask her is, what is the best thing I get to do? And she says, be Dada. You know, and boy, I tell you what, for perspective, that was the greatest thing in my life, because I never thought I would ever be lucky enough to do that. You know, I had given up hope on that. And again, just when I seem to give up hope on my higher power, he shows me again, I am wrong, and that I need to humble myself to a power greater than myself, because my best thinking got me to this room. If I think for a second that I'm in charge, I'm going to fall on my butt. In the program, we call it your ass falling off, but that's fine. And it's something that happens to remind me that I am not in charge in any way, shape, or form. You know, we have been down a road together that I can say, you know, honestly is the best that I have ever been down. And I have been blessed with these things in my life. I have nothing to do with them. I simply showed up, went down a path I thought I'm supposed to go, and these wonderful things happened. And it didn't mean that bad things or sad things didn't happen either. We went through a long stretch with my mom in cancer, and it was difficult. It was so hard to see what this woman was going through. And there was so much anger and there was so much rage at doctors, because I find that one of my character defects is I don't care much for doctors. You know, and they watched the spot for a year and it's okay, it's not growing. And when they finally went in to get it, it was stage 3 cancer. And, you know, and my fantasies of grabbing the surgeon and dangling him out the 3rd-story window at Huntington Memorial, you know, but unfortunately, as my wife said, this guy's probably going to have to help, or you might not want to kill him just yet. You know, it, you know, and watching my mom teach me how to go through this stuff, you know, my mom, I now know that she was teaching me how to take care of pain, because I've had my own issues in the last 3 years. But, you know, just watching all of her friends, all her AA friends that just drove me nuts because I couldn't get them out of the room, you know, and she needs to rest. Get out, because, again, I have no issues of control whatsoever. Get out. I know what's best. Get out of my mother's room. You know, it was one of those things where, you know, we prayed a lot, and, you know, I can't thank my in-laws enough because they were the constant built-in babysitter when we were doing multiple days at Huntington when things didn't look good. You know, and my prayers were more of threats at that time. I remember that distinctly. You know, how dare you bring her this far to have this occur? How dare I ask or say something like that after all the blessings that I have had? And again, where I deserve to be punished, I was shown mercy. And that is a theme that has gone on over and over and over again. That when I get out of my own way, when I stop thinking I'm in charge, then things go really well. You know, I had a sponsor tell me once that I was every alcoholic's worst nightmare. I was an Al-Anon with a badge and a gun. And I've had a lot of Al-Anons call me up and ask me to go on ride-alongs because they want to see, you know, can we find a drunk? Sure. I work in La Puente. They're in every corner. Let's go talk to one, you know. And, you know, it was one of those things. I remember that one of the more fun jobs I had back in the late 80s when I went out to patrol. I was in the city of Carson, and I had the job I had right before I left the station was that of the drunk car. My job was to go out and find drunk drivers. Oh, what a wonderful job for an Al-Anon, you know. And you know, I would put him in the back seat, and I'd drive him around a little bit and say, okay, you're about to get a nudge from a judge. Okay, there's the Alana Club you're going to get sent to for 30 and 30. And there's this thing called a court card, you know, and let me do some prep work for you here, you know. But I got to treat those folks with dignity. you know, because people have treated me with dignity when I truly did not deserve it. You know, again, if I remember and subscribe to the belief that alcoholism is a disease, all I get to do is what I'm supposed to do is be there and be supportive. You know, and remember that the worst enemy I have today is not the drunks. It is me. And if I can stay out of my own way long enough, good things will happen. You know, I have been blessed beyond belief. I could stand up here for a long time boring you with the minor details of the incredible miracles that have occurred in my life. You know, I've been blessed with the love of a woman who puts up with more than absolutely humanly possible, with a wonderful schedule at work, a constantly changing schedules, assignment schedules. When we started dating, I was, you know, I had played hockey for years, so there was two or three games of that a week. You know, I was in the middle of a very, very career-threatening investigation at that time that came out in my favor, another miracle. And, you know, and she started dating me in the middle of all this. And then driving an hour and a half a day for the privilege because she was still working in Irvine and we lived in Covina. You know, 3 years ago, I felt a little twinge in my back. I said, well, what's that? I've never had any back issues. I've always had knee issues. Hockey players have knee issues. And, you know, I said, oh, no big deal. But within a couple of months, that twinge became something that was really painful. And then my right arm went dead, which for, you know, since I have to use my right hand to carry that gun at work, that's kind of difficult to work. And I remember coming home after dropping my weapon in the middle of a qualification course, telling my wife, something's seriously wrong. You know, and again, going back to doctors and threatening them and doing MIR, damn it, and do it my way. And, you know, and then finding out later that I had degenerate disc syndrome. And, you know, and having literally a life change in a sentence of here's what you won't be able to do. You know, and, you know, this woman has stayed with me through all of this, and she took care of me. After, you know, now I just tell people I had Peyton Manning surgery. Everybody knows what that is now, you know, where they went in and took out the disc and put in titanium and steel and cadaver bone. And you know, I lost a lot of mobility and I still have daily chronic pain. And you know, this is as good as it's going to get. And I understand that. And again, because that's how my mom taught me how to do pain when she was going through cancer, was to do it with a smile on your face and to get through it and do the best you can. And then give the day back to your higher power, and she taught me how to do that. But this woman here was the one that was my power behind me. My mom called me her rock. This was my rock. And on those days when it's still just horribly bad, and the last couple of days have been real interesting, you know, and I'm still at work, and I'm still pushing through that, but I know that that's something that may end very soon also. I really don't wish to medically retire. I've been at this gig for 28 years, and I love what I do. But I also know that God will not bring me this far to drop me off, that there is something else that will be presented to me if that is what is going to occur. I'd like to thank the committee for asking my family and I to come and share in this with you, and please keep the faith. God bless.
This recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.